Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. This week's episode marks sort of a milestone, as this is my 100th episode. I want to thank all of the thousands and thousands of my listeners and subscribers out there that listen every week. I never dreamed I would make it to 100 episodes, but here we are. I want to dedicate this episode to the children of Lee Harvey Oswald, Rachel and June Oswald. I know both of these ladies suffered a great deal over the years and have lived with what history said their father did. June, who was born on February 15, 1962, is 63 years old today and became a writer. Rachel, who was born on October 20, 1963, is 61 years old now and went on to become a nurse. Lee's wife Marina and her husband Kenneth Porter did a great job raising the girls and sheltered them in every way possible. But what history did to their father still haunts them even today.
Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
For 61 years, attention has been focused on the conspirators who planned, organized, and executed the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dealey Plaza. They have largely gotten away with their crime. They have gotten away with murder. But they have gotten away with a second murder also, and the framing of an innocent man to take the blame for their cowardly and treacherous actions. They have ruined the name and legacy of a young man who served his country with a vigor and dedication few have matched. That young man is Lee Harvey Oswald. Let's look at the actual life and accomplishments of Lee Harvey Oswald up until the time of his murder, when he was only 24 years old. By stepping back and viewing his life, it is possible to contrast his actions with those of the coward who would shoot him down in the basement of Dallas City Jail. Lee Harvey Oswald was a true patriot, trained in intelligence, and was dedicated to working for his country. Oswald enlisted in the United States Marine Corps on October 24, 1956, just 1 week after his 17th birthday. His primary training was in radar operation, which required a security clearance. In May 1957, he was granted final clearance to handle classified matter up to and including confidential, after careful check of local records had disclosed, quote, no derogatory data, end quote. This is important, because as we know, the Warren Commission and so many so-called journalists, paid under the CIA's Project Mockingbird, by the way, will use Oswald's rough upbringings to chastise him as loveless and try to portray him as troubled. He was no more troubled than any other youth living in poverty and trying to grow up without a father. Oswald was extremely intelligent. At Kessler Air Force Base in Mississippi, Oswald finished 7th in a class of 30 in the Aircraft Control and Warning Operator course, which included instruction in aircraft surveillance and the use of radar. He was given the military occupational specialty of aviation electronics operator. He reported to Marine Corps Air Station El Toro in California. And it was at El Toro that the CIA recruited top candidates for their clandestine operations. These young Marines were perfect. They were young, dedicated patriots who were already cleared for top security operations. The Warren Commission states that when Oswald was in the Marines, he taught himself the Russian language. That assertion is ridiculous. How many 17 and 18-year-old new Marines who are busy trying to achieve a confidential classification in radar and aircraft surveillance have time to teach themselves a language as difficult as Russian? Lee Oswald was identified as very bright and was sent to the California coast to the Monterey Language School, where he was taught Russian and became indoctrinated by the CIA for missions abroad. Most members of the Warren Commission, and especially former CIA Director Alan Dulles, knew these facts about Oswald, but chose to slander his name, reputation, and innocence by fabricating a fictitious lone nut theory surrounding him. Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union was planned and executed by James Jesus Angleton, who was chief of the counterintelligence for the Central Intelligence Agency. Angleton was the undisputed champion of clandestine intelligence operations, and just one of the operations he ran was a fake spy program. Oswald had been groomed for this operation from the time he had learned Russian at the Monetary Language School. He was instructed to lay groundwork for his interest in the Soviet system. Remember, Oswald had security clearance up to confidential and was working in radar systems at the Tugi Air Force Base in Japan and tracked a top-secret U-2 spy aircraft. Angleton and his CIA hoped they could dangle the prospect of radar secrets to the Soviets as an enticement to accept Oswald as a real defector. Every indication is that the Soviets never bought the story. On September 11, 1959, he received a hardship discharge from active service, claiming his mother needed care. But get this, Oswald spent only 2 days with his mother in Fort Worth, then embarked by ship on September 20th from New Orleans to France, and immediately traveled to the United Kingdom. Why would Oswald have been granted an early discharge if he were not preparing for his fake defection? He arrived in Southampton, England on October 9th and told officials he had $700 and planned to stay for 1 week. But on that very same day, he flew to Helsinki, Finland. Please hear this. There were no commercial flights on October 9th to Helsinki. Oswald had to have traveled via military or CIA transport. Oswald was then issued a Soviet visa on October 14th. In Helsinki the following day, he crossed the Soviet border and arrived in Moscow on October 16th. The CIA also arranged for their paid operative journalist Priscilla Johnson McMillan, already in Moscow, to interview Oswald in Russia. This will be the same journalist that will be called before the Warren Commission to help detail the lone nut description of Oswald. She will then go on to write a book about Marina and Lee Oswald that again fits perfectly with the lone nut scenario. Oswald could have never been welcomed back into the U.S. with open arms if he was a real defector. In March 1961, Oswald met Marina Pusikova, a 19-year-old pharmacology student. They married just 6 weeks later. Marina's uncle worked for Soviet domestic intelligence, and questions would later be raised about whether Marina herself was an agent. Oswald and Marina applied at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow for documents that enabled her to immigrate to the U.S. just 1 week later. Did you hear that? Just 1 week later. The U.S. Embassy gave Oswald a loan of $435.71. So Oswald, Marina, and their infant daughter left for the United States. Does it make any sense at all that Oswald would be allowed back into the U.S. almost immediately and given a loan if he was a real defector? The CIA will report that they never bothered to interview Oswald. Of course, that is a damn lie. For decades, nearly every fact that the CIA will report about Oswald, including Mexico City trip and the weekend of the assassination, will be a lie. Why the Central Intelligence Agency to this day withholds critical documents about their relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald speaks volumes. If he was truly a lone nut shooter, the CIA would have revealed everything they possessed about Oswald immediately after Dealey Plaza. Oswald was also given a job at Jagger, Childs & Stovall, a photographic firm that contracted to make highly classified maps for the U.S. Army. Not a job you would give a real defector, would you? He never could have gotten that job without the confidential clearance he earned or the job at the Riley Coffee Company, which was a CIA front company in New Orleans. Does this sound like a true defector to Russia? Back in Dallas in early 1963, Oswald was given a new assignment and new handlers, George DeMorenshield and Ruth and Michael Payne. DeMorenshield reached the United States in 1938. The British intelligence services warned the American government they suspected he was still working for German intelligence and was pro-Nazi. In 1939, he went to work for Humble Oil, a company that was co-founded by Prescott Bush. DeMorenshield befriended Oswald and provided him money and other resources while he was handling him, including taking Oswald to anti-Castro meetings in Dallas. DeMorenshield was making sure Oswald was where the CIA wanted him to go and what they wanted him to be doing. Even Oswald himself was not aware of his manipulation at the time. DeMorenshield was rewarded by the CIA with a lucrative contract with an oil deal he was negotiating with Pop Doc Duvall, the Haitian dictator. In March 1963, he got the contract from the Haitian government. DeMorenshield then handed off Oswald to Ruth and Michael Payne, who would handle Oswald from the summer of 1963 to Kennedy's assassination a few months later in November. You can go back and listen to episode 40 of this podcast that will help you fully understand just how connected the Paines were to the CIA and how they were not what they seemed to be. Michael was also the stepson of the inventor of the Bell helicopter and worked with confidential clearance at the Bell helicopter plant in Fort Worth. It was Ruth who would invite Marina and her children to live with her in Dallas. It was Ruth that would get Oswald the job at the Texas School Book Depository. It was Ruth who would supposedly find letters linking Oswald to the General Walker incident. It was Ruth who mysteriously found another trove of materials that would link Oswald to Mexico City when there was real doubt about him even being there. And then there's her estranged husband Michael, who takes Oswald to numerous political meetings in October and November 1963 rather than spend time with his children on the weekends. It will also be in Ruth and Michael Paine's garage, weeks after the assassination, that an Imperial reflex camera will miraculously show up in a duffel bag owned by Lee that had already been searched. This is the camera that supposedly took the famous backyard photos, though Marina would deny she took the photos. The FBI would try to hide Michael Paine's Minox spy camera that was found but would later admit he owned it. According to telephone company records, Michael Paine placed a call to his wife Ruth at 1 p.m. on November 22, 1963, the day of the assassination. Keep in mind, Oswald would not be arrested until 1:45 p.m. later that day in the Texas Theater. At the 1 p.m. phone call, the Paines talked while the operator remained on the line. The operator later told the FBI that the man on the phone said, quote, he felt sure Lee Harvey Oswald had killed President Kennedy, but he did not feel Oswald was responsible, end quote. Michael then told Ruth, quote, we both know who is responsible, end quote. What did Michael Paine mean? And why did the Warren Commission not question him at all about this call, even though they possessed the relevant phone company records and the FBI report? Then there's New Orleans. Lee Harvey Oswald was seen all around New Orleans in the summer of 1963 with Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and Clay Shaw. The Warren Commission and their paid journalists actually expected us to believe that there was no credible evidence that Oswald, Ferry, and Shaw knew each other in New Orleans. Nothing could be further from the truth. Oswald was first seen in Jackson, Louisiana, about 10 miles west of Clinton. He went to a barbershop for a haircut and also to ask about any jobs in the area. The barber, Mr. McGahee, suggested the State Mental Hospital might be hiring. But what Oswald and his two escorts, Ferry and Shaw, didn't know, that the civil rights group, CORE, had scheduled a voter registration rally that day at the hospital. Many people now saw the trio. Some of these witnesses were re-interviewed by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and the committee found them quite credible. Witnesses like William Dunn and Henry Clark identified the two other men with Oswald that day were Clay Shaw and David Ferry. But remember, the Warren Commission said that these men never knew each other. In the Jim Garrison trial against Clay Shaw, Garrison had 13 witnesses that saw all three men together on numerous occasions. State employee witnesses also saw Oswald's job application. But get this, when Jim Garrison tried to subpoena the application for the trial, he was told it had disappeared. While in New Orleans, Oswald worked at Riley Foods, which was a CIA front. Also while in New Orleans, Oswald would accompany Guy Bannister to college campuses for right-wing recruitment events. Guy Bannister was the former FBI station head in Chicago and assistant superintendent of the New Orleans Police Department. Oswald also worked Al Bannister's office at 544 Camp Street, right in the middle of the intelligence service addresses in New Orleans.
This was in 63.
Sure, Guy Bannister, ex-FBI man, died a couple years ago.
Bannister head of the Chicago office. When he retired, he became a private eye here. I used to have lunch with John Birch Society, Minuteman.
Oh, yeah, I remember
right
that.
Right there to the right of Attila the Hun. Used to recruit college students, infiltrate radical organizations on campus. Headed the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, all out of this office. Come around here, I want to show you something. See that? Now take a look here. 544 Camp Street. 531 Lafayette Street. Same building, right? But with different addresses and different entrances, both going to the same place, to the office upstairs. Guess who used this address? Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, how do we know he was here? Because this office address was stamped on the pro-Castro leaflets he was handing out in the summer of 63 down on Canal Street. Now, these are the same leaflets they found in his garage in Dallas.
What's this?
What the hell is this doing on this piece of paper?
After the arrest, 544 Camp Street never appeared on the pamphlets again.
Yes.
He was arrested that day for fighting with some anti-Castro Cubans. But actually, he had contacted them a few days earlier as an ex-Marine trying to join their anti-Castro crusade. When they heard he was now pro-Castro, well, they paid him a visit.
What is this be that shit? You lied to me, you hypocrite! Liar, you son of a bitch! People do not take this paper. It's a communist propaganda.
Hey, Collins.
Come on, you pink of shit. Go back to Moscow.
There was no real fight, and the arresting lieutenant later said he felt it was a staged incident. In jail, Oswald has a private session with Special Agent John Quigley of the FBI. Oswald is released, and Quigley destroys his notes from the interview. The arrest gets him a lot of publicity, and as a result, Oswald appears on a local TV debate.
But you are a communist, are you not?
No, Mr. Bringier. I am not a communist. I'm Marxist-Leninist.
You are not a communist, but you are a Marxist-Leninist? What is the difference?
And here's another one for you. What would you say if I told you the Oswald was trained in the Russian language when he was a Marine?
I say he's probably getting intelligence training.
Well, you were in the Marines. Who would be running that training?
Office of Naval Intelligence.
Take a look across the street.
Post office.
Upstairs in 1963, that was the Office of Naval Intelligence. Just by coincidence, Bannister, before he was FBI, was O&I. Now, what's that little saying they have?
Once O&I, always O&I.
Well, he likes working near his old pals.
Bill, Lou, we are standing in the heart of the United States government's intelligence community here in New Orleans. That's the FBI there, all right? That's the CIA. That's the Secret Service. That's the O&I. Now, doesn't this seem to you a rather strange place for a communist to spend his spare time?
Oswald pretended to be pro-Castro, to spy and infiltrate their organizations and memberships. Oswald and Bannister also stored arms and ammunition in the offices and distributed it to anti-Castro Cubans at paramilitary camps at Lake Pontchartrain. Oswald also assisted David Ferry in the care of mice and supplies for Dr. Mary Sherman of the Ochsner Clinic in her work to produce a fast-acting cancer virus to be used as a method of assassination of Fidel Castro for the CIA. Lee Oswald most probably saved John Kennedy's life in Chicago on November 2, 1963.
What many people do not know, even those who are familiar with most of the facts of the JFK case, is that there were two plots to kill President Kennedy in November of 1963. The first one was 3 weeks earlier in Chicago. Kennedy was supposed to arrive at O'Hare Airport on Saturday, November the 2nd at 11:40 a.m. He was to attend the Army Air Force football game at Soldier Field. But on Wednesday, October 30th, the FBI told the Secret Service in Chicago that a plot was afoot to kill Kennedy there.
There were actually two tips that reached the Secret Service in the week before JFK's trip to Chicago, and the two were interrelated. The FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover reported the first tip. Hoover's information was that at least one hit team with high-powered rifles would attempt to shoot the president from a warehouse or office building overlooking the president's motorcade route that coming Saturday. Does that sound familiar? Get this. An FBI informant named Lee provided the information, and yes, the Lee providing the tip and probably saving JFK's life that weekend may well have been Lee Harvey Oswald. Again, it was a tip from an FBI informant named Lee that alerted Hoover to the Chicago plot. And we know that Oswald was indeed a paid informant for Hoover's FBI. But it gets even more interesting. About the exact time JFK is scheduled to visit Chicago, half a world away in Vietnam, South Vietnamese President Diem and his brother are murdered in a CIA-sponsored plot. False CIA cables sent from Washington seemingly give Kennedy's okay for the assassination, even though he has ordered the CIA multiple times not to proceed in their request to kill Diem. Here is famed CIA agent E. Howard Hunt, later testifying before a congressional committee about the false cables.
Just that I might be able to improve upon the record.
And what did you understand him to mean to, when he said to improve upon the record?
To fabricate cables that could substitute for the missing chronological cables.
Did you, in fact, fabricate cables for the purpose of indicating the relationship of the Kennedy administration and the assassination of Diem?
I did.
And did you show these fabricated cables, Mr. Colson?
I did.
The CIA expected they could get away with it, as they expected Kennedy to also be murdered in Chicago the same day. Please go back and listen to episode 84 that tells all about the plot to kill JFK in Chicago, and how if it would have succeeded, the name we would all remember would not have been Lee Harvey Oswald, but would have been Thomas Arthur Valley. For Oswald's kids' sake, Rachel and June, I wish that would have been the case. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.